You're listening to Aperitivo, first broadcast on the 22nd of October 2013 on Monocle 24. Aperitivo, brought to you by the Glenlivet. Hello from Midori House in London and welcome to Aperitivo, coming to you live from Studio One and just down the road from the Monocle Cafe. I'm Andrew Tuck. On today's show...
The political opposition, the National Council and the coalition are reluctant to go to Geneva. They're going to Geneva with a weak position vis-à-vis the Assad regime.
Syria's civil war may be heading for peace talks in Switzerland. And in northern Iraq, Kurdish insurgents want talks of their own with Turkey. Shashank Joshi and Daniela Peled are here to tell us more. Then we visit a Vienna publishing house that's found success by becoming the home of quirky Austrian writing by unknown authors.
My sister, she was really the one who started it when she found a note on the street listing pros and cons for a relationship or against a relationship. And that's when I started to realize that this could be a very funny project.
And later in the show, a tale of two Brazilians. We meet a chocolatier at the Monocle Cafe and a musical superstar right here in the studio. That's Aperitivo with me, Andrew Tuck, starting right now. So lots coming up in the next hour here on Aperitivo. But before all that, here's David Spencer with the latest news.
Thank you, Monocle 24 News. I'm David Spencer. Arab and Western foreign ministers have urged opposition leaders from Syria to attend the second Geneva Peace Conference next month. Britain's Foreign Secretary William Hague said there was no way the crisis could end without talks involving all sides. But opposition leaders have insisted they will not attend unless the removal of President Assad is the ultimate goal of the conference. US Secretary of State John Kerry says agreement will not be reached through military action and says progress on chemical weapons shows what can be done.
If it is possible for us to have an agreement which allows people to get on the ground and go into communities and get a hold of chemical weapons, is it really not possible for us to have people on the ground who can go in and get food and medicine to people who are starving and dying for the lack of it?
The trial involving the Bolshoi star dancer Pavel Dmitrychenko has been opened and adjourned. The 29-year-old is accused of arranging an acid attack that nearly blinded the ballet's artistic director. Dmitrychenko and two alleged accomplices could be sentenced to up to 12 years in prison if they are convicted of intentionally causing grievous bodily harm. The reason for the delay until next week was the absence of the lawyer of one of the suspects as he was taking part in another trial. China says it has convicted nearly 150,000 people for corruption since 2008. The president has called corruption a threat to the ruling Communist Party's survival and has vowed to target all levels of business and government. His latest crackdown has netted a handful of senior officials, among them former executives from oil giant PetroChina. The European Union has given the go-ahead to a new round of accession talks with Turkey, ending a three-year hiatus. That's after Germany dropped opposition raised in the wake of a crackdown on street protests over the summer in Turkey. Turkey began negotiations to join the EU in 2005, 18 years after applying, but a series of political obstacles have slowed progress. Lithuanian Foreign Minister Linas Linkevičius said talks would resume soon.
After more than 3 years break, negotiations are regaining momentum, and I hope to see steady and speedy progress. First step will be an accession conference at ministerial level, which we agreed today, scheduled on 5th November in Brussels.
Cuba has taken the first step towards scrapping its two-tier currency, in a move which could boost local workers' income and remove a major hurdle for importers and exporters. The government said it had approved a plan to gradually eliminate the dual monetary system, which has been in place for the last two decades. Cuba's convertible peso, CUC, is pegged to the US dollar, while the local peso, the CUP, is valued at a fraction of the dollar's value, angering the population, which is paid in the latter. Germany's parliament has reconvened for the first time since September's election. The poll saw a surge of support for Chancellor Angela Merkel, and the new lower house has a record number of women members and its first black politicians. Mrs. Merkel is presiding over a caretaker government until she establishes a governing coalition. Formal talks are due to begin on that on Wednesday. That's the latest news on Monocle 24.
Thank you, David. Well, you're listening to Aperitivo here on Monocle 24, and we're going to be right back after this.
Vanuit London, dit is Monocle 24.
London으로부터 Monocle 24입니다.
De Londres, essa é a Monocle 24.
Oi, London, 这是 Monocle 24.
Ot London, tu é Monocle 24.
Fra London, dette é Monocle 24.
From London, this is Londres.
Holanda,
London. London으로부터
Hong Kong.
Hong Kong.
Zurich.
London. London.
This is Monocle 24.
And you're listening to Aperitivo. The time here in London is now 18:06, which means it's 13:06 in New York. And joining me here in this studio with their take on the news are Shashank Joshi, the research fellow at London-based think tank RUSI, and also Daniela Peled, editor at the Institute for War and Peace Reporting. Welcome both to the programme. It's been a day of lots of swirling rumours and wondering what's really going to happen about these Syrian peace talks. For you, actually, when you look at this, Shashank, and you kind of filter this every day, is this a moment of potential hope, do you think, or not?
I think it's horribly pessimistic, actually. It's the worst possible timing. We've just had Saudi Arabia say it's deeply irritated at the United States and it's breaking off cooperation in Syria. So who's going to force these groups to the table? We've just had the head of the Syrian National Coalition say he won't be attending these talks unless there are serious shifts in the conditions. And of course, only a couple of weeks ago, we had this major shift within the Free Syrian Army, the armed wing of the political opposition, peeling away with many Islamists joining hardline groups. So all in all, it's difficult to see how these talks go anywhere. We'll have people at the table, but will anything come of it?
Daniela, are you pessimistic as well at this moment?
I'd have to say I'm horribly pessimistic. I was talking with Shashank just
fantastic,
now, trying to think if we could find some glimmer of hope. And I think it's important to remember that what they're talking about in London today is not a peace plan, it's not a strategy, it's actually about how to bring people to the table, and not even all the actors. I mean, what's going to happen with the jihadis in Syria now?
Right.
It's no longer a bilateral civil war. There are three main parties to the conflict.
And even those at the table will, as you say, represent a narrow slice of the opposition. So let's assume we get a fantastic deal next month, which of course we won't. How would it be respected on the ground? Well, the FSA could obey it, but would Jabhat al-Nusra, would the other al-Qaeda factions, would the Kurds? Of course not.
Now, we're going to have a clip, actually, before we unpack this too much. As you've heard, we are going to start with the Syrian civil war and this fraught march to potential peace talks in late November. Britain's Foreign Secretary, William Hague, today spoke before a meeting of ministers of the so-called London 11, the core group of the Friends of Syria. Hague said that it was vital that all elements of Syria's opposition join these talks, dubbed Geneva 2 in diplomacy circles. Now, a bit earlier, our foreign editor Steve Bloomfield spoke with Fawaz Jerges from the London School of Economics. And even if the National Council and the foreign ministers come together and agree on a plan in Geneva, Steve asked if there was any way it can change the reality on the ground without involving heavy military action. Here's Fawaz.
The Americans and the British and the French and Saudi Arabia and Qatar and Turkey have been trying arming the opposition on the premise that basically by the fall, by October, the balance of power on the ground would be shifted in favor of the opposition. But guess what? The balance of power on the ground has shifted, but unfortunately it has shifted in favor of the Assad regime. But whether you like it or not, the Assad regime has gained the upper hand, is on the offensive, is decimating the ranks of some armed factions on the ground. And without heavy Western military intervention, the reality is it's going to become grammar for the political opposition and the armed opposition. And that's why the political opposition, the National Council and the coalition are reluctant to go to Geneva. They're going to Geneva with a weak position, vis-à-vis the Assad regime.
Shashank, the painful truth is that actually Assad is in a better position now than he's been for a long time.
Well, I'm not sure. I think the rebels simply haven't done as well as we thought they would do, rather. I think both sides are consolidating their positions within their respective spheres of influence. The Assad regime in that little axis going up from Deraa to Damascus up to Homs and the coast, but also the opposition in its own sphere of influence, all along the Euphrates from up in the north near Aleppo province, all the way in the east to the Iraqi border. I think they've done fairly well over the past few months. I don't think Assad is winning. I do think the conflict is stalemated, and that's why we're here.
But he's doing well, surely, in the sense that he's not going to be dislodged from his palace in Damascus anytime soon.
No, absolutely.
And for you, Daniel, when we look at this, you wonder when it all began 2 years ago. There was a feeling that it might be another kind of Libya campaign. This whole thing would be over in a matter of weeks, and that we would by now have a nice democratic government sitting there. Do you think that the West maybe should not have backed the opposition in the way it's done? Either it should have gone in very effectively and really helped it kind of for regime change. But this kind of meddling on the sidelines, it just seems to have extended a war for 2 years. 100,000 people are dead, and it's very hard to see who the winners are at the moment.
Yeah, the fact is that Assad's backers have been consistent all the way through in their policy, whereas the rebels' allies have we've wibbled, we've wobbled. There hasn't been a policy. And when this started, this was a peaceful uprising, a non-violent movement, a genuine one. And when it became more and more violent, there was talk of there was going to be a tipping point. The tipping point was going to be when there was fighting in Aleppo. Then the tipping point was going to be when there was going to be fighting around Damascus. Then it was going to be with defections from the army. We've passed the tipping point, And we're beyond the point now where anything is really going to make a difference, beyond a massive military intervention. That's not going to happen. So yes, we're going to Geneva II in a very weak position. It's quite clear that the West have no coherent policy and they have no willingness to intervene.
And Shashank, do you think that actually many in the West have kind of lost the stomach for this fight in a way? That when you have the British Foreign Secretary saying it's imperative that everybody attends these talks, it just sounds like they're trying to hope now that there will be some peaceful negotiation. Whereas actually a year ago they seemed to be confident that they wouldn't need these kind of talks, that there would be regime change.
I think that's exactly right. I think we are here precisely because we have lost the stomach for any further involvement on the ground, not just in terms of airstrikes, but also provision of arms, which of course was US policy a few months ago, but never really materialized because there were simply too many concerns about the fragmentation of the rebellion, the Islamist character of the rebellion. Those concerns have got worse. In this country, of course, it's not just losing the stomach, it's losing the political fight. Parliament's vote against intervention was really important because not just did it tie David Cameron's hands in providing arms to rebels, as he was so enthusiastic about this time last year, it also tied his hands on providing weapons. So it's a really serious blow. It takes us out of the fight. Who's left? Well, you have really France cheering on from the sidelines, but also diminishing in volume.
And you also hinted at the top of the show there, which I'll pick up with Daniela, the other weird fissure that's now happened is because there is some kind of rapprochement potentially with Iran. Syria, the Saudis rather, are furious about what's going on. They feel that they've kind of been, they've been left out of the debate, that they should be kind of having more influence what's going on the ground. Again, do you think that the countries that were supposedly supporting the opposition are now kind of falling out with each other as well?
Well, absolutely. As I said, there's been no coherent strategy. There's been no coherent backing for the rebels. And I disagree with Shashank because I think Assad is notably more confident. I mean, his perception of where he is, at least, he is now moving to change the media focus for a start. Obviously, he feels confident enough to have let Human Rights Watch in a couple of weeks ago to investigate abuses by the rebels in Latakia.
And we haven't, of course, mentioned the chemical weapons deal, which, although I supported it, I can see why it has also given his regime a certain symbolic fillip. And it means that his own government is now more important to disarmament than it was before. It really doesn't prolong his life, but I think it gives him a certain degree of insulation.
And do you think that his willingness to go along with that process also kind of helped him paint himself maybe as a bit more of a kind of, a deal maker than he really is?
Yes, I think that's right. He gave a wonderful interview to, was it George Stephanopoulos? Oh no, Charlie Rose on the American networks. And the wonderful thing is he's not like Gaddafi. He doesn't rant about Al-Qaeda or rave or hector. He's very smooth. He uses his Western education and his erudition
very soft-spoken
to appeal to Western audiences, uses their language about terrorism and extremism. A very clever operator, and the chemical weapons deal helped many to, helped him to sell the idea, I'm the reasonable one. It's my opponents who are unreasonable. And I think this is why Geneva 2 is so important. It's not that the West thinks we will get a peace settlement, it's that we have to try, otherwise we look like the baddies.
And what do you think, Daniel, is a possible kind of way ahead? If these peace talks don't work, if, the opposition will not come to the talks, if the Saudis encourage them to stay away, what route is there forwards, do you think?
Well, I think we should cast our minds back to May 2012, Geneva 1. I mean, if the talks go ahead as they're planned for November, then there's been a clear 18 months for Kofi Annan's famous six-point plan to have been implemented. I mean, if we remember, part of this was, I think there was going to be a two-hour daily humanitarian ceasefire.
I mean,
it seems ludicrous to think about it now. And this was with Russian support. And Kofi Annan resigned a couple of months later. Well, maybe Lakhdar Brahimi is going to resign as well. I mean, I think it's in the international community's interest to have Geneva 2 because they want to feel, the diplomats want to talk about a process.
Right. They have to talk about something.
There isn't a process.
And Shashank, as this goes on and on, everyone's very clear that it's kind of, torn the country apart in very real ways. In towns and villages where actually Christians and Muslims did live side by side before, that seems impossible going forward. The sectarianism is so powerful now. Do you think even if there is a peace negotiation, there is no way back to the kind of easy on the ground kind of Syria that there was in the past?
I think these sorts of conflicts have real scarring effects on countries. Lebanon, of course, was once a Switzerland of the Middle East, and the conflict there, which raged for years and years and years, tore apart the social fabric of the nation. And although they tried to stitch it back together, it never really restored itself to the sort of pluralistic society it once was. And sectarianism became woven into the very fabric of the place.
And I wonder, Daniel, Shashank mentions Lebanon, the neighbours, Turkey must certainly hope there is some kind of way out of this morass. They have 500,000 now people from Syria living within their country. Do you think there's any pressure from those neighbouring countries to kind of actually come to some kind of deal, or are the Turks and also still kind of hoping there will be proper regime change?
Well, I'm surprised really that the Turks have not taken a more leading role in this. They've got certainly very pressing interests here. But yeah, the pressures on the neighbouring regions, the neighbouring countries, I mean, the pressure on Jordan, which has already got more refugees than it knows what to deal with, is enormous. The pressures on the Turkish border. Israel is watching the events to its north with interest.
And Iraq is deteriorating into some of the worst violence we've seen in a decade. So with elections coming up next year, I mean, virtually every single country on the periphery of Syria has been deeply affected.
And I think this is why as well we see the international community in such a state, because the repercussions, if things continued in the trajectory, are so huge and so complex, it's very difficult to even conceive of it.
Well, I think we all understand the pessimism that you expressed at the top of the show. We're going to take a short break now. You're listening to Aperitivo with me, Andrew Tuck.
The Glenlivet was the first single malt to successfully cross the Atlantic Ocean. And since that first journey, the world-renowned whiskey has never looked back. Now, master distiller Alan Winchester is inviting their global community of whisky connoisseurs, the guardians of the Glenlivet, to help create their next limited edition whisky. To discover more and write the next chapter of the legacy, join the guardians at theglenlivet.com. The Glenlivet, the single malt that started it all. Enjoy responsibly.
Each week, Section D takes a thorough look at the design world. From fashion to furniture, from lighting to tasteful living, we'll bring you the most interesting news from design studios across the globe.
Where is society going? What is the furniture that will lead what society will want in terms of furniture functions and forms?
we see that more and more contemporary designers actually do not think about the mass-produced object. That's not what drives them. That's not what they're interested in. That's not what they think they want to contribute to this world.
You can't really create 240 years of a story. What I'm saying is the brand has incredible authenticity and creates integrity.
It's not just making clothes, but shoes and accessories and thinking about the character or the narrative of the collection.
Join me, Tom Morris, on Section D, your one-stop guide to the world of design.
That's Section D, premiering every Tuesday at 1900 hours London time, in association with Lexis.
And welcome back to Aperitivo here on Monocle 24. Still with me is Shashank Joshi, research fellow at RUSI, and Daniela Peled, editor at the Institute for War and Peace Reporting. Let's turn our focus now to Turkey. The head of the Kurdistan Workers' Party, the insurgent group known as the PKK, has said his forces are ready and able to re-enter Turkish territory from their perch in northern Iraq. That's unless the Turkish government gets serious about its peace process. The PKK accuses Turkey of waging a proxy war in northern Syria against the Kurds by backing Islamist rebels who are fighting them. So, Shashank, another very complicated story, and we're going to touch in a moment on the EU's involvement in this story as well. It seemed that we were edging towards a kind of a real proper peace deal only a few weeks ago. What's the problem?
Well, first of all, when Prime Minister Erdogan within Turkey initiated this peace process, he was riding pretty high. He had just secured an apology from Israel. He was domestically in strong standing. And then, of course, you had these major protests in the summer that really weakened his political position and meant that he was liable to be really weakened at home amongst his opposition. So I think that's made it very hard for him to make the necessary concessions. But the Kurdish issue was also closely connected to all of these regional elements we've been talking about. So, for example, the worse Turkey's relationship with Iran, the more paranoid Turkey gets that Iran is supporting Kurdish rebels, not necessarily the PKK, but others. So I think it's subject to so many moving parts, including Turkey's relationship with Baghdad, that it's very, very easy for all of this to have fallen apart.
And we were talking there a little bit about the EU, because it does come as an interesting time. The EU today agreed to hold a new round of accession talks with Ankara in early November, following Turkey's domestic crackdown earlier this year. Germany had protested at EU talks, but now it's back down. So the sweetener in this is, I guess, if the Turkey does want to join the EU any day, and it seems to kind of waver whether it does or doesn't, it does need to find some negotiated peace deal with the PKK and with the Kurds. Do you think there is still an appetite for joining the EU? And do you think that is enough to kind of get some momentum to these talks again?
Well, there is and there isn't. There's an appetite for the process within Turkey. Whether Ankara really thinks it's going to join the EU, it seems very doubtful. I mean, the statements coming out from officials are more or less saying, well, you know, we know it's not going to happen, but we're going to get closer and closer. I mean, they get a lot out of the process as well.
So explain to me, what do they get out of being part of the process, do you think?
Well, you know, greater access to funds, research and development, but also in terms of political standing. I mean, Turkey is in a very strong position now and likes to think that they need the EU needs them more than they need the EU. So the idea that they are engaged in these talks and this process, it's largely symbolic. You know, I mean, Erdogan's been going through this democratization process, but also it's aided him. He's managed to put the military kind of in its place, which has consolidated his rule. But also with the elections due next year, he wants to establish his powers as president. He'll probably win again. He wants to establish his powers even further. And that doesn't quite chime with what the EU wants him to do.
And do you think, Shashank, that actually if they in the end of the day, they think they're probably not going to join the EU, again, it takes off the heat, the desire to kind of actually come to some kind of settlement then?
Yes, I also think there are probably internal fissures within Turkey as well. You obviously have the foreign minister, Mr. Davutoglu, who has traditionally espoused what became known as sort of neo-Ottomanism, Turkey's Influence in the Middle East. It would mediate disputes like the Iranian nuclear problem. It would become a beacon of Islamic democracy for countries like Tunisia and Egypt. And I think Erdogan was never quite as enthusiastic about this particular process. But what's happening now is with Erdogan weakened, his political ambitions for next year, as you just said, peaked. He wants a beefed up presidency. There's enormous flux within Turkish politics. And I think no one really knows where all this will end up. We've had a long, long period of complete dominance of Turkish politics by Erdogan. Now, of course, the AK party will continue to dominate Turkish politics, but Erdogan personally may find himself not edged out, but perhaps sharing power with a greater range of new actors, many of whom may wish to move Turkey in different directions. So I think it's in a very formative stage. It doesn't quite know where it's looking, and it's had so many successive failures within the Middle East. Its Syria policy is in tatters. Its nuclear diplomacy with Iran is utterly messed up. It now is trying to reground itself, I think.
I wonder with Erdogan, it seems that sometimes he acts in the kind of heat of the moment. He seems like somebody who, you know, he had a Syria policy, he kind of threw it out the window, decided to go after Bashar al-Assad. With the PKK, he doesn't seem to hold a line very clearly. And you see this a little bit coming from the president's office as well. The president is always seeming to be implying, you know, actually calm down a little bit. You know, we need to take a bit of more of a middle ground here. Do you think that, you know, that there is a kind of problem with Erdogan and his foreign policy that it is a little bit kind of knee-jerk on occasion?
It's going to make a terrible joke about the ghoul cop and the bad cop. But I think you're right. I mean, in fairness, we do have to remember here that the Turks were very patient with Assad at the beginning of this conflict. They did not rush into this saying Assad must go. They tried to leverage what had been a pretty decently built up relationship with Damascus to try and persuade him to reform. Now, some of those reforms were less than savory. They wanted him to, for example, conduct sham elections and said, look, why don't you just hold some pretend elections? It'll take the heat off you. They eventually shifted to this. I think what where they really overplayed their hand was in thinking the NATO cavalry was coming. NATO would bail them out, intervention would come. Intervention hasn't come. And the Turks have been absolutely flustered as a response because they can't now go back. And they've alienated some of the Arab states too. Saudi Arabia now sees Turkey as working with Qatar to back Muslim Brotherhood elements within Syria and elsewhere. So they've not only alienated themselves from some of their NATO allies, from Syria, from Iran, of course, but also even from some of those anti-Assad states who see the Turks as being far too gung-ho, which is why some of the most interesting stuff now is going on not from Turkish soil, but from Jordanian soil.
Danilo, you hinted also that, you know, the Turks feel that they're kind of, you know, so powerful now that the EU needs them. But they must feel a little bit kind of that things haven't really gone their way. As we said, you know, they thought they had this influence over Assad. It turned out that they didn't. They felt that the EU would be courting them a little bit more than it probably has been. Do you think that they worry a little bit that their kind of foreign policy remit isn't actually kind of not just working out, it's not quite listened to in the way that they had hoped?
Well, for quite a while, the foreign policy was predicated on being friends with neighbours. Now, it's quite difficult to maintain that if your neighbours aren't playing ball. Well, I mean,
or if you alienate them needlessly. I mean, the big news this week, of course, was David Ignatius' story in the Washington Post. Turkey had leaked the name of 10 Iranian agents whom Israel was talking to the Iranians. I mean, absolutely incredible. So when you talk about impulsiveness, well, that's pretty damn impulsive.
And Daniela, do you think that you know, for Turkey and the PKK, what will happen next, do you think?
Well, I don't think Erdogan's in a position now where he really wants to go in heavy. He could give some more concessions. I mean, again, the democratization process that he announced this month does give a fair amount of, perhaps symbolic, but it is also very important symbolic concessions that occurred. So he's finally allowed the 3 banned Kurdish letters, which means that Kurdish children can be given, you know, Kurdish names. I mean,
they're allowed to have an X at last, I believe.
Exactly.
Is one of the letters allowed.
Exactly.
And Shashank, if you were, you know, we started at the top of this show with talking about the foreign minister here in the UK, but if you're any foreign minister watching the kind of, you know, what's playing out both in Syria and in Turkey, do you think that your Middle East department is probably being run ragged trying to kind of explain all of this? Because It's a moving mess, isn't it? It's just very hard for, you know, we see it from all of these governments, whether we look at Paris, you know, Washington, London. nobody seems to be able to hold a line and really know what's happening.
And there are so many layers. There's a strategic layer, Saudi Arabia versus Israel, the US versus, excuse me, Saudi Arabia versus Iran, Israel versus Iran. There's an ethnic layer, Kurds versus Arabs, and there's a sectarian layer, Shia versus Sunni. And those don't all map perfectly onto each other. So grasping any of this is so, so difficult. I really empathize with all of those foreign ministries struggling to write sharp, succinct briefings right now.
Well, we're going to have to leave it there with some sympathy there from our team for the foreign ministers around the world. Shashank Joshi, Research Fellow at RUSI, and Daniela Peled, Editor at the Institute for War and Peace Reporting. Thank you very much for joining us here at Midori House.
Vanuit London, dit is Monocle 24.
London으로부터 Monocle 24입니다.
De Londres, essa é a Monocle 24.
Oi, London. 这是 Monocle 24.
Ot London, tu vai Monocle 24.
Fra London, dette Monocle 24.
From London, this is Londres.
Holanda.
London, London으로부터
Hong Kong.
Hong Kong.
Hong Kong.
Zurich.
London.
London.
This is Monocle 24.
Plenty still to come then in the second half of today's aperitivo. We'll head to the Monocle Cafe to sample some Brazilian chocolate. We'll have a special musical guest here in the studio and we'll visit the publishing home for quirky Austrian writing. Before we get started on all that, here's David Spencer with the world news headlines.
Thank you very much indeed. Plans for peace talks to end the fighting in Syria are in the balance after opposition groups refuse to attend unless President Bashar al-Assad is forced from power. Arab and Western foreign ministers have pressed Syria's fractured opposition to join the proposed peace talks in Geneva next month at a meeting in London. The UN Human Rights Council has criticised China during an official review of its human rights record. Many members of the council expressed concern at the arrest of dissidents, the continued use of the death penalty, and the use of torture in prisons. Authorities in Russia's southern city of Volgograd have declared 3 days of mourning after six people were killed in an attack by a female suicide bomber. The bus blast on Monday also injured 28 people. Firefighters in Australia have deliberately carried out an operation where two large fires were joined together into one larger blaze in a bid to control bushfires raging across New South Wales. Teams near the Blue Mountains, on the edge of Sydney, are engaged in extensive back-burning operations ahead of worsening conditions expected on Wednesday. The United States economy added 148,000 jobs in September, lower than expected. The data has been released late because of the shutdown in the US government. Those are the latest headlines on Monocle 24.
Thank you, David. Thank you for running us through all the news headlines. And welcome back, everyone, to Aperitivo, live here on Monocle 24. The time is now 21:32 in Moscow, and it's 18:32 here in London, which means it's 15:32 in Rio de Janeiro. And time now to head to the Monocle Cafe on Chiltern Street for coffee and a chat. Today, actually, we're also going to have some chocolate. That's because Samantha Akeem, chef chocolatier of Chew Chocolates even, is here in London. She came to promote the chocolate that hails from a cocoa plantation in Bahia State. Akeem is planning to export her products to Europe and the UK, where they're already available at Fortnum and Mason. The vibrant packaging of Chew Chocolates received an award at the Cannes Design Festival back in June. No surprise when you see all the tropical elements, animals and plants native to the cocoa plantation, such as armadillos, monkeys, and of course, tropical birds. Monocle's resident Brazilian, Fernando Augusto Pacheco, is at the cafe now with Samantha. Fernando, over to you. And that's if your mouth isn't already full of chocolate.
It's almost full of chocolate. Thanks, Andrew. And good to see you, Samantha. Bem-vinda. What brings you to London this time?
Well, we're talking about our chocolate that is selling at Fortnum & Mason. And we're here for the Salon du Chocolat. First time in London.
Fantastic. Are you representing the Brazilians there?
Yes, for sure, and bringing a little of our forests and flavors.
Let's go a little bit through your products. I have here an amazing selection, and we go through the packaging after, which I'm a big fan. But so which kind of products are you going to sell in the UK? And besides the UK, do you plan to export to other countries, like in Europe or in other countries as well?
Well, we're here at Fortin & Mason's and also at La Grande Épicerie de Paris at Paris, and also in the U.S. already. And we're bringing the whole collection for Christmas in those little boxes with all the products. And we have the big bars with the animals that you love so much. And they are all strong chocolates with only cocoa butter and sugar.
And this little box that you just showed me, first of all, you have to mention that it comes with the Christ the Redeemer in a bronze metallic, you can describe better than me.
Well, it's a way to keep Rio de Janeiro with us all the time because we come from Rio. And for us, Cariocas, that means good luck and just a remembering home a little.
And there's kind of six selections, like with the one I'm going to try now is 55% cocoa, which is actually quite a lot, but then you have one with 85 as well.
And it gets better and better. And the higher the percentage of cocoa, the better it is. And you can see that it's soft enough to be very agreeable, much better than having milk or caramel chocolate. It's healthier. And you can really feel and sense the cocoa, the fruit, with all its personality. So
I can feel it right now. But Samantha, where does the beans come from? There's a very nice story of where they come from. They come from Bahia, right?
Exactly. We select our beans in one single plantation in South Bahia. And all our inspiration comes from this place. And also that's you can see that in all the packaging. We have the rainforest and the animals. So it's a very, very specific situation where I go myself to this place to select the best of each harvest to create this collection, which is the Q collection.
And who helped you with the packaging, which just won an award in Cannes this year as well?
Yeah, it was amazing. Well, we had an idea to bring a little more of cocoa to chocolate and try to explain that cocoa is a fruit. So the idea was to bring, like the botanist in the beginning of last century, bringing the atmosphere of the plantation, the plants. And we worked with a Brazilian design called Claudio Novais.
Oh, fantastic. And now I want to talk a little bit more about the Brazilian chocolate industry. Do you think Brazilians are appreciating more chocolate? Because we're discussing at the moment we have quite a, I don't know how to say, very sweet taste for chocolate. It's not kind of officially good chocolate, the ones we eat at the moment. But do you think it's growing, the market for premium chocolates in Brazil?
It is. Actually, it is. What we can say is that if we consider the average of consumption in the entire country, it's not that high. But when we look to the numbers at South Brazil, it would be like France consumption of chocolate. And what we see today is a very key point about health issues and eating health and better. And that's where chocolate comes and enters into the game because it is pure chocolate, pure cocoa, low sugar, so it's healthier and it's better. So I can say that we opened at Rio two stores that are maybe the only stores in the world that sells only dark chocolate. That's something that we are putting out there and it's working very well. So yeah, this is changing.
That's what I was going to ask about your business model. So how does it work? I mean, I know you're trying to export to other countries as well, you just mentioned. But what about in Brazil itself? Do you have the shop in Rio or do you sell in other states as well, in São Paulo, for example?
We sell in Rio. We have two stores in Rio. And we sell also, we have a little pack-up store in Rio as well. And we're going to São Paulo beginning of next year. And yes, going to the world as well. We're just talking about going to China. So maybe 2014, we're arriving there. Let's see. Let's hope.
Fantastic. Cracking the Chinese market. Perfect. Which one is your favorite, Samantha? I mean, I have to say, I love this one with the green parrot as well. Not only the packaging, the flavor is good as well.
Yeah.
But just choose one.
I would go for the 85, which is only cocoa and sugar, because for me, it's the best one.
Well, thank you very much. Muito obrigado, Samantha. And now we go back to Studio One with Andrew.
Thank you very much, Fernando. You certainly do get some tough stories to cover. Make sure you get back here quite quickly, and I'll have the green parrot one. That sounds very nice. Well, that was Fernando Acosta Pacheco, and he was with Samantha Akeem, who's the chief and the chef chocolatier at Q Chocolates. Up next, we're in Vienna. Stay tuned for this episode of Aperitivo on Monocle 24.
Inspiring the likes of Charles Dickens since 1824, the Glenlivet may be the definitive Speyside single malt whiskey, but that's just one chapter of the story. Master distiller Alan Winchester is inviting the Glenlivet's global community of whiskey connoisseurs to help curate the flavors of their next limited edition whiskey, The Guardian's Chapter. To discover more, join the Guardians at theglenlivet.com. The Glenlivet, the single malt that started it all. Enjoy responsibly.
Are you tired of overcooked and overrated culinary trends that never quite hit the spot? Cookery books that leave a bad taste in the mouth? Fed up of being spoon-fed half-baked ideas on the next big thing? Then tune into The Menu with me, Markus Hippi. Every week we introduce you to the world's top makers and shakers, cocktail creators and the best bread makers as we uncover gourmet street food, big-time baristas and wily wineries.
We're making porchetta sandwiches. It's a roast pork belly with some Italian seasonings. Just really simple, salt, pepper, fennel pollen. Simple, tasty.
I think food off a grill really just tastes exceptional. It's the sort of thing I like to eat, you know. Lamb, chicken, even octopus, squid, always tastes good.
This is the show that discovers how coffee can change a country and how chocolate can make us live longer, all in the search for exciting local food producers and the most original entrepreneurs.
You don't make business lunches here. You come usually alone or with somebody that you know very well, because it's homey style. You have to feel familiar with someone to eat in such a place.
That's The Menu, every Friday at 1900 hours London time.
Welcome back to Aperitivo with me, Andrew Tuck. To print solely what you like is a dream entertained by many publishers, yet very few of them ever come to realise it. But the Austrian publisher Edition Krill seems to be doing just that. Led by two enthusiasts, Edition Krill is the home of quirky Austrian writing by largely unknown authors. Our man in Vienna, Alexei Korolyov, went to meet the people behind it.
We came up with the idea to do it because we thought there are many books which are not yet being printed.
Virgil Guggenberger is a co-founder of Edition Krill, an independent Vienna-based publishing house whose catalogue is determined exclusively on a whim.
One of our main principles is that we do not want ourselves to be fixed to a certain program, but our main program is that what we like. What we try to have is the variety of books we do or publish. We try to keep as big as possible.
Edition Krill's most recent release is 15 Decker Extra Wurst, 150 grams of sausage by Sigrid Ibe Green. Named after a cryptic message found in a park, it is an anthology of random notes that Ibe Green, a lecturer at the Vienna Academy of Fine Arts, had been collecting over several years.
It's really a project that I'm doing with my sister, Margaret, and she was really the one who started it when she found a note on the street listing pros and cons for a relationship or against a relationship. I almost threw it away, and then I found another note. And then I found another note. It was a shopping list, very simple, but it was written by some old person with a very old-fashioned handwriting, and I felt bad throwing it away. And then I finally thought, well, it's kind of a collection. Got three notes here, so... And that's when I started to realize that this could be a very funny project.
She says it has been a life-changing experience.
It starts to change you a little bit. It starts the way you look at things, the appreciation for everyday routines, because it's almost like mushroom hunting, where you are on your way and you're always alert.
It's proven difficult to quit, though, Ibe Green says.
At some point, I was always looking for a reason to stop. One idea was when I found a note that said fertig, which means finished. That's God speaking, that might be a hint. But then I found some other really funny notes, or people gave notes to me, and then I realized, well, it's not the right time yet.
Another recent Edition Krill publication is Kravanka, a novella by Swiss-born writer Bruno Palandini. It charts the life of a man who arrives in a remote Austrian village in the hope of renting out a house there but the landlord is nowhere to be found. The man starts to live in the house all the same and is gradually accepted by the villagers as its new owner. But there is something more behind this story, Pelandini says.
The idea was that this house could be a symbol of life. It's a gift we have for a certain time. The day you die, you give it back. And it's up to you what you make out of your life.
With its intricate layout and design, Kravanka is a typically niche product that bigger Austrian publishers would hardly consider taking on, Pelandini says.
The thing about the Austrian publishers is that they are not really free about what they do. Sometimes I have the feeling that they act like printing offices. They do one book after the other and don't have the time or the capacities to push one book or to follow a writer through years.
But despite all the freedom that Edizione Krill enjoys, it can only publish 2 books per year at the most, says Wolfgang Gosch, Edizione Krill's other co-founder.
Our normal profession doesn't provide us with enough free time to do this more exclusively.
Besides, it's a struggle finding money.
A lot of money is from my side, and we always try to get funding for each book. But there is also Verlagsförderung, which is overall funding. Right now it's still that we apply for each book and we always get a little bit, but it's not so much that it would be paid already. So the printing cost is, let's say, half paid and the other half is on my side.
Sailing the rough seas, or more likely travelling by airmail, are 12 books comprising the Edizione Krill's honourable book flotilla.
We understood those books like ships, like expedition ships being sent away to some place you don't know.
Each book was christened something like the Cumulus or the Earl of Dyke and dispatched to roam the globe, Guggenberger says.
We sent them to 12 people around the world, from Vienna, of course, but also New York or I think Shanghai one was too. And some of those people we knew personally. Some we knew by business, and we sent them those books, asking them, please, this book is empty, write, paint, or put in which way or manner you want something into the book, and then send it on to somebody else.
Guggenberger hopes some of them will eventually return.
Our idea is that some days some, or maybe one, or maybe all of those books might come back to the Edizione Krill, and we'll see what's in them, and of course we will publish then some facsimile of them.
For Monocle in Vienna, I am Alexei Korolev.
Well, a nice report there about Austrian publishing. Stay with us, we're going to be back in just a moment. We're going to have a song in a moment, but before that, we're going to hear what's coming up on the rest of the day on Monocle 24. I'm joined in the studio by the producers of those two shows. Daphne, first of all, you're going to be looking after the world of globalist Asia. What
indeed
you got tonight?
We are going to lead with a report by Amnesty International and Human Rights Watch saying that the US drone strikes against Afghanistan, Yemen, Pakistan should be classified as war crimes. So that's going to be an interesting conversation. Basically, it's obviously there's been a very damning report that proves that many civilians have been killed, a long investigation, and we'll be speaking. We've spoken with Amnesty International already, and we'll be speaking to a writer that has covered the issue extensively for Salon.com in the United States.
And have you got anything more fun? Well, that's quite fun, but yeah.
It's interesting, I would say. I'm not sure it's fun. We will indeed be asking whether Canberra is not the most boring city in the world anymore, because now it has gay marriage, as opposed to the rest of Australia.
Now, this is quite interesting, because the Australians, the government, the central government, isn't really kind of keen on this at all. So this is kind of a bit of wily activism.
Yeah, it's quite amazing, actually. And yes, in 2004, the federal government actually passed a law saying that gay marriage was between a man and a woman, so it'll be interesting to see how that pans out.
And what do we have on the daily tonight?
On The Daily, we'll be taking a look at the Obamacare website, which has been having numerous issues. It's basically crashed, which has somewhat scuppered attempts to roll out Obamacare across the US. So we'll be talking with a reporter who's been chatting with various programmers who've basically said that it was nowhere near ready, and there were huge number of issues with the coding, but they were forced into putting it out.
And just tell me, you know, that healthcare story has been on the front of all the papers today. It does seem to be one of these awful things. Whenever we kind of roll out anything to do with kind of like healthcare, there's always like a problem with the computers, a problem with the planning. These things tend to be teething problems, don't they, in the beginning?
Yeah, well, it wasn't just teething problems, unfortunately, in the UK with the NHS, which isn't something we'll be focusing on. However, we'll be talking with the leader of a project in Finland, which actually had huge success with changing its interface in enabling the Finnish government to interact with Finnish people over healthcare and social services.
Brilliant. And well, I think that's all good. In the moment, we're going to be having some Brazilian music. But for the moment, Annabelle and Daphne, thank you very much for coming in to see us and tell us about both of your shows later on. And it's time for a bit of music now. We've just had a live performance of the Brazilian music superstar Thaís Gullin in our canteen come performance space. And she's going to join us here in just a moment. But first, here's her song, Cinema Big Butts.
I like big butts and I cannot lie. Your other brothers can deny. And when a girl walks in with an itty bitty waist and round thing in your face, you get sprung. Wanna pull off stuff because you noticed that butt was stuffed. Deep in the jeans she's wearing, I'm hooked and I can't stop staring. Oh baby, I wanna get with ya and take your picture. My homeboys try to warn me that butt you've got.
Well, that was Cinema Big Butts by Thaís Gullin, who I'm very happy to say now joins me in the studio. I kind of missed the live show because it was going on while we've been doing this show that's been recorded for later on in the week. But I heard the cheering and everyone very happy. And we've also dragged into the studio Fernando, who is just down at the cafe doing our other Brazilian report because he's from Team Brazil as well.
With some hard work.
Yes, doing the chocolate. Eating the chocolate. Thaís, first of all, that song, interesting that you switch between Portuguese and English. I'm sure you love singing in both languages, but for you commercially, as you begin to look for an audience outside Brazil as well, is it helpful to have some songs where you mix English and Brazilian, or English and Portuguese rather?
I think it could be helpful, but I wasn't thinking about that actually. I really like this song.
It's a surprising name, Cinema Big Butts. You're going along nice and peacefully and melodic, and then suddenly there's a change of pace in there.
Yeah, it's kind of the lyrics go like the opposite. The first song in Portuguese is like kind of like a critic to American society, and the other one goes right there to I like big butts, and and then when it stops, it says I like better our samba singers, but actually I don't really, you know, they are like the opposite, but they are like sisters.
Now, we're very lucky to have you here in the studio, but you've also been singing, you're going to be singing in a museum at Ronnie Scott's. Is this because I know your past was as an actress? Are you kind of used to kind of working in almost any environment that you do your songs? You seem to be happy to sing in all sorts of places.
Yes, I am. We had this concert at Guggenheim Museum. I was so happy to sing there. I was surprised with the invitation, and at Ronnie Scott's too. And yes, I kind of like to sing anywhere. Yeah.
And Fernando, you can pitch in as well with a question if you'd like.
Well, you know, I'm very happy. You know, I told Thais that after I seen the video for Cinema Big Butts, I said we need to have Thais in the studio. You know,
you said we need big butts.
We need big butts, and I think it adds some.
That's not my case.
No, sorry. I mean, that was, you know, it adds this melodic, suave Brazilian tones, and suddenly, you know, this rap kind of I like big butts and I can't deny. I love this kind of mixtures.
And tell me the audiences you've found as you've gone around. You've been in Spain. You've been here in the UK. Obviously, there's a good expat community, but are you feeling you're pulling in a kind of fresh audience of, you know, Spanish people and British people as well coming to see you?
Yes, and I was surprised with the reactions. I thought they were really hot, public, warm.
Good. Yeah,
but
good.
No, they were hot.
They're hot. They're hot. I'm not sure who you were looking at in the audience, but some of them may be hot. You never know.
There's one quick question. Because a lot of artists, when they go to Brazil, they say that actually the Brazilian audience, they can be a bit crazy. Do you see that? Do you know the Brazilian public, they are quite wild, you know, in your shows, for example?
Yes, yes. Especially in Northeast, they're, yeah.
Oh, good. Well, thank you, Thais. It's been lovely to meet you. And so we'll be hearing more of that session here on Monocle 24 during the week. And I think if Fernando's nice, he may let you have some of the Brazilian chocolate as well. But that's all we have time for today on today's Aperitivo. My thanks in particular to our special guests, Shashank Joshi from RUSI and Daniela Pellard, editor at the Institute for War and Peace Reporting. Today's show was produced by Daniel Giacopelli and researched by Alexa Firmanich and Maddie Arauju. Our studio manager was Sam Impey. Next, after the headlines, is Section D with Tom Morris. Here's a taste of what's to come.
What makes a successful designer in Toronto is someone who has the roots here, but is also kind of looking at other cities to show in or to sell in.
And then at 2000 hours London time, we'll have the Globalist Asia. And then at 2200 hours, it's the Monocle Daily. This show will be back at the same time tomorrow at 1800 hours London time. But for this edition of Aperitivo, it's time for me, Andrew Tuck, to say goodbye and thank you for listening.
The Rolex Mentor and Protégé Arts Initiative sources young artists across seven disciplines and brings them together with artistic masters for a year of mentoring. For mentors, it's a year to share their passion and expertise. For protégés, it's a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity to observe and work alongside some of the world's greatest artists. For Rolex, it's a chance to ensure the world's artistic legacy is passed on to the next generation. One year can inspire a lifetime.